House Transportation Policy and Regional Governance Committee is called to order. I want to welcome everyone back. We're going to look forward to a productive session this year and working with all of you. So may I have a motion to approve the minutes, please? Representative Barr moves approval of the minutes for March 15th, 2017. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes of March 15th are approved. You're going to see a few new faces here in the committee. We have, we lost Abby Loesch. She had her baby, Wilson, and she's decided to stay home with him. So Steve Bartle is replacing Abby. And then we have Chelsea Axelson. And she's been with the GOP, and she was the CLA for Transportation Finance last year. So she'll be our researcher. So we're glad to have both these guys, and we thank you very much for being with our committee. So today we have three presentations from MnDOT. They've been doing some excellent work this past session, so we're eager to hear several presentations from them. So we have Mr. Rudine, first of all, and Mr. Roy are going to be bringing us the tolling study. So we'll wait for that. And then MnPass Express Lane Financial Report is up next, and then the Highway Construction Cost and Cost Inflation Study. So we'll have lots of good information here to get us going. So welcome, Mr. Rudine, and please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs, and I'll just say a couple of introductory comments and then turn it over to Mr. Roy. We were asked by the legislature to do this tolling study. This was not a MnDOT initiative, but we were happy to do the study and provide information about tolling in Minnesota. And before we start, it's just important to note that this is not a plan for implementing tolling in Minnesota. This was just a very high-level analysis of the types of revenues that could be generated if tolling were implemented. So if the legislature and policymakers decide to go this direction, we would need a lot more analysis on specific corridors before we could implement tolling in the state of Minnesota. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Roy, who was involved in putting the study together.
Welcome, Mr. Roy.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak about this study. My name is Christopher Roy. I'm with Minnesota Department of Transportation in their Engineering Services Division. In the legislation that was passed last year, it asked us to look into 10 particular areas that in very broad categories can be divided into three of those broader categories: modern tolling practices, policy and legal considerations, and traffic and revenue analysis. Each one of those three areas I'll kind of step through in the presentation here, talking a little bit about each one of those as we move forward here. This slide here I'd like to come back to and take them just a little bit out of order. I think it'll make it a little bit easier for the presentation, so I'll come back to this one. One of the things that we looked at was kind of the national tolling map. In total, there's roughly 30 states or so that have some level of tolling. And what you can see up on the map behind me here are those states that are in purple or all in the same color, orange. Those are interoperable, meaning that if you have a toll mechanism, a transponder, you're able to go from state to state and pay that other state's toll using your state's transponder. On a kind of a national level, this is something that states are really working hard to have that interoperability between the different states so that it's much easier for the user to pass from one state to the other. Some of these states really only have kind of the equivalent of MnPass lane, which is a hot lane, a high occupancy or tolling lane. Others have the tollway, like Pennsylvania, where it's one edge of the state to the other edge of the state, where it's tolling all the way across the board. Yeah. And some of these states actually have some dynamic tolls as well, meaning that the price of the toll varies depending upon the time of day, the congestion level. Others are fixed. Most of them are migrating towards an electronic means for toll collection, whether it's the transponder or taking pictures of license plates and tolling that way. Just about every state is in some state of converting entirely to electronic. So there's no longer a need to stop at the toll booth and pay your toll using cash, although some states still have that as an option. So what we did was we took a look at those states as well as some national literature on screening criteria for what makes a good toll road. That national literature talks a little bit about a handful of items that they feel make some very good screening criteria, and we applied those items. It was congestion relief potential, revenue generation potential, traffic volumes, truck traffic volumes, road classification, financial viability. We looked at those from that national study and actually selected a couple of things very specifically to use for that screening tool on which roads would we select as a representative sample for tolling and doing the analysis inside of the study. So one of the things is 10,000 vehicles per day. So any for a highway to be eligible for this particular study, we decided that a minimum threshold of 10,000 vehicles per day needed to be on that roadway. So we only looked at roads that had more than that traffic volume. We were looking for limited access roadways. That limited access just makes it much easier to actually assess the toll because you don't have multiple as many points to actually collect that toll or to be able to have to set up those gantries. So we're looking more at the freeway interstate style of roadway.
Mr. Roy, would you be willing to take a couple of questions as we go along?
Oh, certainly.
Okay. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Roy. So I'm going to ask a very basic question, but I always like to start out with did you look into, you know, what is the purpose and outcome for these toll roads? What problem were these locations or states trying to solve for? Are they just simply trying to raise money? Are they trying to help with congestion and other traffic flow issues? Or I just would like to know what challenges they were trying to solve for.
Mr. Roy.
Madam Chair and Representative, we did do a couple of case studies, a little bit deeper dive into a couple of different particular areas. And in most instances, the newer tolls are actually trying to resolve an issue. And that issue could be congestion mitigation. There you probably would lean a little bit more towards the hot lane concept, that high occupancy tolling lane where maybe it's a congestion price. I think there's an upcoming presentation on that and can learn a little bit more about what that is. Another group of states, though, might have been trying to fix a particular problem. They might have had a bridge, for example. I think it was in Washington. They had a couple of very large bridges that needed to be replaced, and they decided to do tolling in order to collect revenue to pay for those new bridges.
Right. Please proceed, and thank you.
So moving back to the selection criteria, so it was 10,000 vehicles or greater a day, limited access roadways, and then we also looked at traffic volumes per lane, which is getting at that congestion. How much congestion do we have on our roadway? And those highways that have more congestion kind of lend itself a little bit better to tolling. And then we also looked at the availability of competing roadways and or frontage roads. If there's a toll on one of our highways and there's another highway not so far away or there's a frontage road system, there's going to be more people choosing to divert onto those other roadways as opposed to paying the toll on our roadway. So we wanted to kind of take a look at how close were these other things. So when we looked at all of that criteria, we got to this map here that were a handful of, actually seven, highways that were selected as a representative sample for what tolling might be able to generate if it were implemented. A couple of the highways, 35 from roughly Forest Lake up towards Duluth, portions of 94 from Rogers up towards St. Cloud, and Highway 52 between the Twin Cities and Rochester are more rural sort of highways. And we wanted to see what potential there was for toll revenues on roadways like that, implementing kind of a more of a turnpike style of toll, something more like what maybe Indiana or Pennsylvania might do. The other highways, 610-94 in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area going over to Wisconsin, 35W, the entire distance of 35W from Lakeville up to Forest Lake, as well as 169, were more of an urban representative sample. And we wanted to see what kind of possibilities there were for revenue generation in the urban area.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, and I've lived in Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana, so I'm familiar with the tolls. But when you're talking about congestion and limited access, how do the tollways actually improve congestion? Because I'm just thinking you're putting the people that want to pay in one lane and everybody's the rest are left to squeeze in the others. So how do you mitigate congestion?
Mr. Roy.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think the gentleman coming up will speak a little bit more to that. But in very simple terms, what it's doing is we do congestion pricing. So with that, originally they were HOV only lanes, and we have made it an option for a single occupancy vehicle to buy that additional capacity in that highway, or in that particular lane, I should have said, to buy that additional capacity in that particular lane. So it actually takes it out of the general purpose lanes, and it does free up some space in those general purpose lanes because some people are opting to move into what used to be only that HOV high occupancy vehicle lane and paying that toll if they're a single occupant vehicle. If it were tolled across the entire highway, all general purpose lanes as well as what maybe is now a hot lane, if that toll is across the entire highway and it's dynamically priced, how it controls congestion is through time of day. If it's dynamically priced, meaning that price varies throughout the day, you'd pay a higher price during higher congestion times. So people would start making some choices. Do they want to pay that higher toll because they have to be somewhere at that precise time? Or if they have some availability of differing times of arrival or departure, they might choose to go a little bit earlier or a little bit later to avoid that higher toll. So there are a couple of ways where tolls can be used to kind of help mitigate some congestion on the highways.
Okay, Mr. Roy, please proceed.
So just flipping back through the slides that we already covered to the next one here, toll prices. So in order to do kind of a revenue analysis, what we needed to look at was what was a reasonable amount for the toll to be. We looked at a handful of the states near us, and what we found was the cost of those tolls ranged from roughly 4 cents per mile all the way up to about 15 cents per mile. And that range was a little bit dependent on which state you were in. Was it used for congestion pricing, or was it more of the turnpike sort of idea? And then we also looked at what was the additional cost for trucks. And that premium for a truck was somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.6 to 6.1 times greater than the price of a two-axle or a passenger vehicle. So knowing that information, what we decided to do was to take a look at three different tolling rates. We did one at 10 cents per mile, at 7 cents per mile, and then one at 4 cents per mile. And when we did that, we were able to kind of look at some sensitivity. Did a higher toll that would probably result in more diversion? What kind of revenue would we get there? The analysis that will come up a little bit later is actually using that medium rate of toll, or that seven cents per mile. We also needed to define what the diversion rate was going to be. So we selected, and this is based with our consultant who has national experience, that on an urban interstate, only about 15% of the vehicles would actually divert onto other roadways. Rural interstate and urban freeways, about 20% of those vehicles would actually divert onto other roadways, and rural freeways actually had the largest amount of diversion of 25%. So we used that as just kind of a basic rule of thumb to give us some analysis on how many cars might be diverting versus those paying the toll. So the estimated revenue for each one of the corridors is shown on this screen. And describing a little bit about the different colors. The first one is the orange portion, which is always the lowest portion of that bar graph. What consists in the orange portion is really the cost to construct the tolling on the highway. So it's the gantries, the overhead sign bridges that are required. It's all that infrastructure that's required in order to actually start collecting the toll. Cameras, fiber optics, so that we can communicate back to an administrative office. The administrative cost itself would actually be in there as well. And then the cost to maintain just the tolling components of the toll roads are shown in that orange portion. The gray portion is actually the cost to maintain the roadway. That would be snow removal, crack sealing, pothole filling, those types of things. Because in most instances, if not in every instance, a large part of the revenue collected on the tollway has to be reinvested back into the highway. And we felt that was a pretty fair assumption to make. And so the gray cost would be the cost just to maintain the highway that we'd be doing regardless if there were tolling or not. But it shows a part of that revenue being used to do that maintenance of the highway. That gold portion or yellow portion is the potential revenue generated by any one of these representative corridors over 30 years when we factor in inflation. So in the case of 94, that portion is about $3 billion, but that's spread out over 30 years, and it's actually adjusted for inflation. So that's probably only has the buying power of about $1 billion to maybe $1.5 billion today. That segment of highway is a 51-mile segment of roadway, and the cost to reconstruct it currently is much, much greater than that revenue that's generated there. So the cost of reconstructing our highways is growing exponentially, and even though this might be a source of revenue, it will not cover the cost to reconstruct all of our highways.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a couple questions for Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Roy, when you talked about the toll prices on the prior slide, was that, I might have missed this, but was that based on like more of a turnpike style where every lane is paying, or was that based on like a min pass where you have one lane that you're offloading people to?
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair and Representative, in this case, it's actually every lane is being tolled is what we're comparing it to. There are some states that have shorter segments that have tollways like that. For example, the Northeast Extension down at the bottom, that'd be an example of a shorter system, whereas some of the turnpikes up there, the Kansas Turnpike, the Oklahoma Turnpike are longer distance sort of tollways, but in every case it is every lane. There was no consideration for the hot lane in this particular study. So a hot lane example is actually in the upcoming study here, and they'll talk a little bit more about what's happening there.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Roy, thank you for giving this chart, but I want to make sure that I fully understand what this says. Are you telling me that, this example, the first column, the gold portion of it, which is just a little over $2 million up to $5 million, that is the total revenue, or is the total revenue from the bottom line up to that $5
million? Okay.
Mr. Roy.
Billion. Billion.
Madam Chair and Representative, the entire bar graph is the revenue. The entire bar graph is more of the gross revenue. Once you subtract out the cost, like the administrative cost for the tolling, the orange portion, and the maintenance cost on the roadway, snow removal, things like that, the yellow portion would be the equivalent to like a net revenue. So that'd be the amount of additional funds that would be available for other purposes.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's kind of what I anticipated, but I wasn't sure by your testimony when you said only the I-94 was only $3 billion. Am I correct also, though, that the roadway operating and management costs are also over that 30-year period that you're anticipating as well?
They are.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Roy.
Yeah. Actually, maybe expand just a bit on that, all of the costs shown here are across that 30 years and inflated as well, not just the that yellow portion. One thing that Eric did touch on, this being a planning level study, it really is a very high level study. There were lots of assumptions that we needed to make in order to get to these types of revenues. And I think if any further consideration is made, I think what really needs to be done is a feasibility study to really look harder at the individual corridors and what needs to be done there, looking at the number of exact gantry points. All of those types of things really would need to be completed prior to any additional implementation of this. And I think that direction would need to come, and the decision would need to come from policyholders if we should really be looking into that at feasibility of these corridors. But what I want to emphasize is this planning level document is very high level, and there were numerous assumptions going into it. So these revenues are also based on a lot of those assumptions, not the least of is inflation and what's inflation going to do over 30 years, but also that diversion rate. Talked a little bit about that, and we might be grossly underestimating it, but on a national level, those were fair numbers to start with.
Okay. Representative Iwakim has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Roy, I'm glad you mentioned the cost of the study. I know up to $600,000 was kind of earmarked out of our trunk highway funds, which I thought was a little odd for the study instead of going through our budget process. But could you tell me, and this was a high-level view, what would the cost of a really specific study to really dig into this? What could you estimate that to be?
Mr. Roy.
Madam Chair and Representative, the cost of this study was actually less than $200,000. As I understand it, Wisconsin had asked for a more detailed level study, so kind of taking the next step. And as I understand it from our consultant who also did that Wisconsin study, it was in the $2 million range. That by itself probably is not quite enough of a study to say these are the exact corridors and this is exactly how we're going to implement the process, but I think it gives a much higher level understanding as to what the potential revenues might be as well as what the potential costs are going to be. It's kind of the equivalent to, if your car is making noises when you apply the brake, you call the mechanic, and the mechanic says, well, it can be anywhere from $50 to $1,000, depends if it's brake dust or if you need an entire brake shop. Mm-hmm. The study we have right now is the equivalent to that phone call where the mechanic said it's somewhere between $50 and $1,000. The next study, it would be the equivalent to the mechanic pulling off the tire, looking at the brakes, and now saying that you need, rotors or brake pads, getting a little bit more specific, but you don't know that exact cost until it's all said and done, which would be that preliminary engineering and final engineering that would go into it prior to construction. So each one of these studies gets you a little bit more detailed information, and but they also cost quite a bit more, like your question stated.
Follow-up?
Mr. Chair, I just want to say thank you for that. That was a great analogy to that. Thank you.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just wondering if in this study, if anything has been given consideration as to how the area has been developing. For the last several decades, it seems like we've been concentrating infrastructure investments and locations for employment and job in a more metro-centric type of pattern where everybody is having to converge like spokes of the wheel to the hub. And could we address some of these issues and problems by maybe refocusing some of our policy decisions about encouraging employment in what were traditionally bedroom communities and dispersing the congestion and dispersing the use of our roads to make it move a little bit better?
Mr. Roy.
Madam Chair and Representative, this particular study didn't look very hard at that. Instead, we looked at the road network that we did have, applied kind of that selection criteria, and just chose representative samples of as to what the potential revenues might be. We did not get into much detail about land use and where jobs might be versus where people are living. Just took that traffic volume and kind of applied that.
Mr. Roy, you mentioned that the $3 billion of, say, excess revenue is hardly enough to cover the costs of 94. What is that cost, then? Over the 30 years, what's the lifetime cost to O&M, I guess, capital and O&M?
Let me see here. All right. Madam Chair, I thought I had the exact number here, but I think the gray portion was factored in at $30,000 per lane mile per year. And the cost of reconstructing, say, 94 is quite expensive. Between the two downtowns, roughly a 11-mile segment, we have current-day estimates at in between maybe $1 billion and maybe $2 billion, depending upon what alternative is selected and how do we rebuild it and to what degree. That would only be roughly 11 miles of that 51-mile segment, so there's still 40 miles or so that need reconstruction. The cost of reconstructing a rural highway is much less than it is in the urban area. We're seeing reconstruction costs in the urban area, probably starting out on the low end of maybe about $10 or $20 million per mile, reaching in excess of $100 million per mile on some of our biggest projects as you get closer to the urban core.
Okay, so we don't know exactly the number, but it's big.
It is. It is a very big
number. Okay, you gave us a good idea of that. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Roy, when you talked about the feasibility study, do those studies ever take a look at the impact to the driver? So, for example, I don't know a lot of people that could reroute themselves, you know, people who have kids and regular day jobs to go at a different time of the day. So the reality is those people have no choice but to pay whatever the current, you know, peak hour fee is for that. And I'm concerned that, you know, those kinds of things could have an impact on people with limited means, number one. And number two, in any of the other feasibility studies that you've looked at from other states, did they include any of those kinds of impacts?
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair and Representative, feasibility studies usually do take into account the impacts that they may have to the driver. Some states have tried to apply means for crediting maybe the frequent user by reducing the toll if they use electronic means, so a transponder or something like that. Some states also reduce that cost or the toll if they do it by prepay as opposed to postpay and then the administrative cost and figuring out what the toll was and charging it back to a credit card. As far as the impacts to maybe different communities along the highway, that would not only be covered possibly in the feasibility study, and it will be addressed in the feasibility study, but much more detail would actually have to be completed in the environmental documentation process before it became a project. In that environmental documentation, we have to look at the social and economic impacts of all of our projects. And in tolling, not only do we have the impacts associated with the construction that actually takes place and maybe impacting wetlands or archaeological sites or contaminated materials in our soils, but we also have to look at environmental justice sorts of things, looking at how we're impacting people of differing income levels. So all of that would be taken care of in the studies that need to occur prior to construction. Some of them would be in the feasibility study, and then more detail would be in that environmental documentation process.
Representative New?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Roy, as part of this, did you also look at the impact on congestion, both on the tollways and on those diversion routes?
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair and Representative, we did not look at congestion levels, aside from what's out there right today. And that helped us determine which corridors we wanted to use as a representative sample. We did apply that diversion rate and subtracted that diversion rate off of the traffic volumes on the roadway so that it does take show up in your revenue computations. But I don't know if, say, for example, 94 is the toll road. We did not go into the level of effort that's required to figure out how many people are going to divert to University Avenue or Highway 36 or 494 instead of being on 94. We didn't look at that level of detail for the study.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you were looking at tolling in other states, is it typically done the revenues that are accrued cover operations and maintenance and debt service and new construction for that specific roadway, or does it go into a broader pool of money? Like, let's say if you pay money on for the Pennsylvania Turnpike, is that going to their Department of Transportation for any expenses, you know, kind of like the gas tax we have here, or is it very much focused on that specific roadway?
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair and Representative, in the vast majority of the instances, it is very specific back to that particular roadway. A couple of case studies have just an ability to have a little bit of additional money maybe going on alternate routes, but the vast majority of the money collected on the tollway is reinvested back in the tollway. In some states, it's actually required by law that it be reinvested back in the tollway itself.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Representative Klasnick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Roy, thanks for being here. Does your study, I don't really see it in here, but did you take a look at the increased economic cost to consumers from the increased tolls, that those prices will get passed on to the consumer as businesses and producers bring those goods to market? What would the effect of that be to consumers?
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair and Representative, we did not look into it with that level of detail.
Mr. Kostick.
Without looking at it, could you maybe guess for us that what would happen to the cost of goods being brought to market, introducing tolls, especially perhaps the Highway 52 corridor, and actually any of the corridors people trying to do business? They're just going to pass it on to the consumer, aren't they?
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't know. We didn't look at it.
Can you give us an educated guess, Madam Chair?
Kostick.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Radin.
Thank you. I'm not sure. I think it's probably safe to assume that, but, you know, without researching, there's probably national literature on that topic that we could try to find for you and get that back to you.
Yes, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We both live along the I-694 corridor, and I noticed it wasn't on this map, and I'm just wondering why. I know there's like, I mean, I'm not saying I want it on there at all, so maybe I shouldn't even ask this question now, but I'm just wondering, the majority of truck traffic use that I-694 as opposed to like 36 or some other highways or interstates. What was the reasoning for not looking at I-694? And thank you for, I guess, not looking at it.
Mr. Roy.
Madam Chair and Representative, basically what we were looking for was one or two highways in each one of the following four categories: urban interstate, rural interstate, urban freeway, and rural freeway. So 694 would fall in that first category, urban interstate.
Okay.
And the two that we selected were 94 and 35W. We just looked at those because we felt that was representative of what was happening both on 694 as well as 494. The truck volumes actually on those two highways we selected, 94 and 35W, are fairly high. They range from about 3.9% to about 11.7% of the overall traffic on those interstates, which is probably not too different than what you would find on 694. It'd be a very similar range of truck traffic. So I think while we did not select 694, we certainly could have, but I think the results that you see on kind of those other two, 35W and 94, would be similar to what we would find on 694. And simply we had to narrow it down because we did not have enough time nor money to research every highway. So we just selected a few that kind of hit those criteria and then study those.
Representative Barr, C.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. The first one is how do you, a lot of these tolls, they're going cashless. So how do you handle unbanked people? You got to put all the apparatus in place to actually put a bill in the mail and get it back. I know Texas does that for their out-of-staters. So anybody who's coming through the metro on a summer vacation to visit a state park, go camping, Brainerd, any of the activities, concerts downtown, you're going to be, has that all been factored in for all of the mailing back for all of these bills for anybody that comes from Hudson to see a concert in St. Paul?
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair and Representative, that is indeed a problem. And we identified that as kind of a policy issue. How would we want to collect that particular toll? You're right. Some states take a photograph of the license plate, and then there's a whole bunch of information that has to be gotten back and forth, a lot of administrative cost in collecting that particular toll. Some states pass that administrative cost, or at least a portion of that administrative cost, back onto the toll. But what we did was we tried to capture somewhat a reasonable amount of administrative cost. We did not get into specifics if we would go back and through video capture how much it would cost per incidence. We did assume a certain amount we would just not be able to capture any toll on, and that was about 1% is what we assumed, which is based on the consultants' experience nationally is a fairly reasonable leakage amount to have. So answering your question, I think we didn't take it into account specifically, but we did try to account for it at a high level a couple of different ways.
Senator Barr?
Second question, your diversion rate, what did you, what percentage did you use for your diversion rate? Because I know Indiana toll road, you can skip the whole toll road and it only takes you, adds 15 minutes to the trip, but in a truck, that's a $40 bill. That's more than any extra fuel I might burn on that. The Ohio Turnpike adds about 35 to 40 minutes to skip the entire toll road. The Kansas Turnpike is about 10 minutes to skip the toll road there. So I was kind of curious what you used for your diversion rate percentage, because 94, unless I have to make a delivery right off I-94, I'm using 694. So your diversion rate numbers on these, unless you're tolling every major road, every four-lane limited access highway in the city, is going to be astronomical, I think.
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair and Representative, so what we did use for the diversion rates were 15% for the urban interstate, 20% for rural interstate and urban freeway, and 25 for rural freeway. Now, in the urban area, our rates are relatively low, but that's because we assumed that it would be a system-wide implementation of tolling. Because if we toll 94, what you said is exactly right. People would divert to other highways and those types of things. This was based on what our consultant had from national experience in national literature on what those diversion rates are. You're right. They could be very different in our state based on maybe our highway system compared to other states. So in that next level of study, if we get to that point, I think we'd need to do more analysis to make sure that those diversion rates are appropriate, or what would the appropriate amount of diversion be for differing highways.
Right. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Roy, just following up on that, so is the assumption with these diversion rates that these are the only roads that would become toll roads, or is the assumption that additional, I think to Representative Barr's point, that, I mean, if the tollways are selective, certainly we have an extensive system, road system, that would allow for higher rates of diversion, perhaps.
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair and Representative, these diversion rates, we're assuming that we would have a complete network of toll roads. So in the metro area, all of our freeways would be tolled. Those are more appropriate diversion rates if all of the freeways were tolled.
Okay. I don't see any further questions, so we want to thank you very much, Mr. Roy, Mr. Rudin.
Thank you.
Appreciate the information. And we'll now move on to the MinPass Express Lane report. Mr. Larson and Mr. Carey. Welcome, gentlemen. Who's going to start?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brad Larson with Minnesota Department of Transportation's Metro District.
And my name is Brian Carey. I'm also with the Minnesota Department of Transportation's Metro District.
Very good. Welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm going to begin by providing some brief background on the MinPass system and program here in Minnesota, as well as a brief overview of the MinPass Express Lane financial report that was submitted to the legislature. And then I'm going to turn it over to Brian. He's going to go into a little more detail on MinPass revenues and expenditures. MinPass is the name of Minnesota's system of price-managed lanes, also known as high-occupancy toll lanes, as was mentioned in the previous study, or hot lanes. These lanes have been in operation here in Minnesota on 394 since 2005 and on 35W since 2009, and most recently on 35E north of St. Paul since 2015. MinPass is a key strategy in the region for improving the highway and transit systems by providing a reliable, congestion-free option for commuters during peak travel times. So how your typical MinPass lane works is that during those peak travel times, which are Monday through Friday, 6 to 10 a.m. and 3 to 7 p.m., transit buses, carpoolers, so vehicles with two or more passengers, and motorcyclists can use those lanes for free. Solo motorists also have the option to use the lane if they have a MinPass account and a MinPass tag, the transponder that was mentioned, mounted to your windshield, for a fee that then varies depending on congestion levels in the corridor. The purpose of that fee is to keep that lane free-flowing, keep it moving at congestion-free speeds. The targeted speeds are 50 to 55 miles per hour. Outside of those peak travel times, the lanes operate just like regular general-purpose lanes. They're open to all motorists, free to all motorists, and that's nearly 90% of the time that they operate as just regular lanes. So why are we developing a MinPass system here in the region? MinPass lanes reduce and better manage congestion in a manner that's more sustainable over the long term. MinPass lanes increase person throughput in congested corridors. A single MinPass lane can carry more than twice as much traffic as a general purpose lane can during peak hour congestion. MinPass lanes also improve travel time reliability in these corridors that are prone to congestion. Commuters in these corridors have the option of a MinPass lane and therefore can plan on or rely upon a 50 to 55 mile an hour trip if they need it. There's no way to provide that same level of travel time reliability in general purpose lanes. And then finally, MinPass lanes improve bus transit service, particularly express commuter service during peak periods, increases ridership on those routes, and also increases carpooling in these corridors. And just wanted to point out that more than 80% of the people who are using these lanes are either riding on bus transit or are on carpools. So with that, turning to the MinPass legislative financial report, this slide provides an overview of the specific items that the legislature requested we cover in the report. And you'll see on here our page references to where they can be found. These items can be found in the report. So capital, maintenance, operations costs for each MinPass lane, condition, projected life expectancy of each lane. There's a cost recovery ratio calculation that's in here for each corridor. And then we have annual revenue and annual cost to participate in the MinPass program. And as I mentioned, Brian's going to go into a little more detail on revenue and expenditures in these corridors. And then also there's the total number and type of user in each lane provided in the report, as well as a description and explanation of how enforcement works in these corridors. So with that, I'll turn it over to Brian to go into the revenue and expenditures. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Carey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the representatives for allowing us to talk about this here today. I'll start here with the 394 corridor. That was the first corridor to implement MinPass back in 2005. I'll refer you to kind of the three bullet points on the left side there. Those are the revenue rules that are actually spelled out in state statute, that the revenues have to first go back to pay the capital costs. In the 394 corridor, that was $8.2 million to implement MinPass on that interstate. The second is to pay the operating costs, what it costs to actually run the system. That can be anything from the contractor we have that assists with running our customer service center as well as our back office system. It can also include some of the enforcement costs that are associated in that as well. After that, if there's dollars remaining above that, remaining revenues are then split 50-50 between MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council for improvements that go back into the corridor. So for MnDOT, that would be some sort of capital improvements or some maybe some maintenance improvements. For Metro Transit, that would be anywhere from capital to operating expenses on those corridors. So to draw your attention to the chart, the green bars represent the toll revenue that has come in year over year since fiscal 2005 to fiscal 2017. And then the other bar chart, the stack bar chart, represents the expenditures. The yellow one being the capital cost repayment that was repainted back to the ABC garages that are on that corridor that funded the original capital cost. After that are those operations and maintenance expenses that I referred to that include everything from enforcement to running the customer service center to the software systems that are required for MinPass. And then we have some Met Council transit payments in fiscal 14 and 17. And then lastly, there's a toll equipment replacement which we had in 14 and 15 as those tolling systems are getting to be 10 years old. So to focus on a couple of highlights there, you can see the yellow area between fiscal 9 and fiscal 13 rather, where we've got a lot of payback expenses back to the ABC garages. It was decided to try to pay that off sooner. As we move forward, I already highlighted the toll equipment replacement, but also in the fiscal 16, you'll see the operations and maintenance expenses went up. Mainly that was because of the replacement of the back office software system, and that started to set us up for interoperability.
Mr. Carey, I'm not aware of the Met Council transit payments. There's just 2 years in which that occurs, and what were those?
So those would be revenues that were given back to Metropolitan Council as defined in that state statute. And so they would go back towards any operating or capital expenses that Metro Transit had. I don't have the exact details as to what that was, but we could provide that if desired.
Representative Barr has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in looking at this chart, I just want to make sure that I'm reading it correctly. So the only 2 years that we had net toll revenue was in fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 17. So that's the first part of my question. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Sorry Madam Chair.
Mr. Carey.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Follow-up. Representative Barr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you were to net out the total costs over this time period and the total revenue, would we be in the black or the red?
Mr. Carey.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have those exact numbers, but I believe we would be in that red where we've had to supplement with some trunk highway operating dollars. But the intent of MinPass is not to make money, but to actually manage the traffic in that lane and try to have that advantage for transit and for carpool vehicles.
Okay. Please proceed, Mr. Carey.
Okay. I'll move on to the next corridor, 35W. Here the revenue rules are a little bit different in state statute. Here we actually allocate the lesser amount of $1 million or 75% of the revenues for operating costs. So those go back to MnDOT to pay for the operating costs of the MnPass system. The remaining amount goes to the Metropolitan Council for those transit improvements, again, whether it's operating or capital. And so that's up to that first million. Once it exceeds that $1 million mark, then the revenue rules actually change, and they change to where remaining revenues get split 25% to MnDOT and then 75% to Met Council. So you can see from the graphs that there's a lot more payment to the Met Council because of the way these revenue rules were developed in state statute. So they're getting a lot more funding kind of starting earlier on as opposed to having to wait until later on as revenues exceed the operating expenses. To highlight a couple of the spikes there, in fiscal 11, that was one of the later stages of 35W. 35W is actually kind of built in stages, and so that reflects one of those stages coming online and having some new infrastructure for that. And then in fiscal 16, it's the same spike that we saw on 394, and that was the portion that 35W paid for to pay for that back office system and software upgrades that we had.
Okay. Representative New has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with that allocation of the remaining dollars, with the 25% to MnDOT and 75% to Met Council, is there any restriction on how those dollars can be used by those entities, or do those just go into their general fund budgets that they can choose to use as they would like?
They're restricted.
Mr. Carey.
Madam Chair, they are restrictions on how they are spent. They have to be spent back into the corridor for either operations or capital expenses, but they do have to be spent back on 35W.
All right. Representative New?
Madam Chair. So how do you define the corridor? What kinds of expenses could that include?
Mr. Carey?
Madam Chair, it's we've actually got an MOU with the Metropolitan Council that kind of defines what some of those expenses are. Mm-hmm. For MnDOT, what it has been is operating expenses and capital expenses for the MnPass system itself. We haven't really had enough revenues to go back into the corridor for other improvements like pavement improvements or bridge improvements. For the Metropolitan Council, I don't have exact details on what it is that they've been spending their portion of the revenues on. It's usually either some sort of operating expense or capital expense, but we could provide that information if it was requested.
Yes, that would be appreciated.
Very good. Yeah. Right. Please proceed, Mr. Carey.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the last corridor here is the I-35E corridor, and this one actually fell under the same rules as the 394 corridor. The 35W corridor had very specific rules written out for it in state statute, so this fell under more of the general rules that 394 fell under. So that required a repayment of the capital costs. In this case, the capital costs were $61 million. The reason being is that it wasn't just for the tolling infrastructure, the technology and hardware. It was actually for the capacity expansion that we had out on 35V to be able to accommodate MnPass because it was a new lane, not transitioning an old HOV lane or general purpose lane. It was new capacity. So after that is paid off, then it follows the same revenue rules of paying for the operating costs and then having a 50-50 split with Met Council. But because of that first one being so large, really the toll revenue is going right back into that capital cost repayment, and operations and maintenance expenses are having to be covered by trunk highway operating dollars.
Okay. I guess I don't see any other questions at this point. I'm sorry, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we go back to slide 4 for a moment? So I feel like I might be on the slow bus, pun intended, today. The first bullet point, sub-bullet point, a single MnPass lane can carry twice as many people as a single general-purpose lane during peak hour congestion. So my question is, were you comparing that single MnPass lane to, for example, if there were four lanes and one is a MnPass lane, are you comparing it to those other three general-purpose lanes, or are you comparing that one MnPass lane to if you had opened up all four lanes for general purpose travel.
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the comparison is a single MinPass lane to a single general purpose lane in that corridor. For example, on 35W, it's comparing the MinPass lane to the adjacent general purpose lane. So just a single lane to a single lane comparison.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have there ever been any studies in looking at what the traffic that a MinPass lane could carry versus if all four of those lanes had been open for general purpose?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative, some of that analysis, similar type analysis that you're asking about, has been recently completed for the I-35W North Corridor, which is about to get under construction later this year. There was quite a bit of in-depth analysis comparing adding an additional lane in that corridor as a MinPass lane compared to a general purpose lane. So we'd be happy to provide some of that information if you'd like to see it.
Thank you. That would be great, Madam Chair.
Great. Representative Barr C.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were on a tour this summer around town. Some folks from MnDOT gave us a little ride around town, showing us what projects they had going, what they'd completed. And during that tour, one of the gentleman that was kind of hosting mentioned that there was a pilot program for some reduced MinPass or free MinPass stuff. Do you know anything about that, free MinPass availability?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, we have been developing a couple different pilot programs that we have not yet implemented, but we are planning to implement here later this summer. One is a veterans discount program where we'd be providing a one-time $50 toll credit amount to both veterans and active military in the corridor. It's one program we've been looking to pilot to see how well that would perform, as well as a low-income discount pilot program where we would be providing $35 in toll credits to individuals who meet certain income eligibility levels. Essentially, for our program right now, we've been developing it for individuals that would have a valid EBT electronic benefits card that they could show when they came in to sign up for MinPass. And so that $35 amount would be available each year that they qualify for that, meet those eligibility standards, and would want to continue in that program.
Right. Representative Barr, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just kind of curious. I'm a veteran myself, and I'm pretty sure that about 35 or 40% of the population right now is a veteran in some form or fashion that would qualify for that. And also the people on EBT card or low income eligibility. Just kind of curious, wouldn't this be social engineering in some form or fashion? Because we all have places to go. It doesn't matter what my income is, whether I served in the military or not. We all have a job to go to. We all have kids to pick up. We're all using the same highway. Why are we separating certain people and privilege that way? I mean, people under 20, college students, I mean, where would the list stop then if you're going to start segregating or pulling certain groups of people out for an exemption or a lower rate? Where would the list stop?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and Representative, these two groups of people that I mentioned, there have been numerous requests over the years from these groups of people for discount programs such as this, or to be able to use the lanes for free. Been a number of legislative proposals that come up each year for those types of things. And nearly all other toll facilities and systems throughout the country offer similar types of discounts in these regards. And so we thought that we would test both of these approaches and see what how well they worked and what kind of impacts they actually had on the performance of the system.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is to either one of you. It's just a curiosity question about the implementation and enforcement of MinPass. So my general understanding is that on these corridors coming into Minneapolis-St. Paul, they're effective in enforced in the morning and going out in the evening or the afternoon time frame. Are there any sections of these corridors, and I'll ask two questions here, are there any sections of these corridors that will be implemented both in the morning and the night? And the other question is, are they enforced on weekends and holidays at any particular time?
Mr. Carey.
Madam Chair and Representative, we do have the 35W corridor between Crosstown Highway 62 and the I-94 corridor. That northern segment actually is tolled both peaks, both directions, just because the amount of traffic that's on that corridor, there's really kind of a commute pattern in both directions during both peaks. So those areas are enforced as well as being tolled during those hours. As far as weekends and holidays, the only segments that there would be tolled on weekends would be the dynamic shoulder lane portion on 35W. It runs from 38th Street northbound into downtown, and that's actually written in statute that if that lane is open to traffic, it has to be tolled. So that section would be tolled. The other section would be the reversible lane section on 394 from Highway 100 to downtown. That is tolled any time that that's open to traffic. And then as far as holidays go, they are tolled and restricted and enforced on holidays just because of the general signage that out on the corridor says Monday through Friday, and it doesn't exclude holidays.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to go without mentioning this because I saw the words benefits of MinPass, and I then I read the title a little bit more, and it was talking about managed congestion. I think it's really important that when we do these types of projects, whether it's MinPass or other projects through communities, that we make sure that we don't reduce the safe mobility of people traveling from one side of the interstate to the other. And for this project, for example, two non-motorized transportation facilities were taken away in a sleepy road that people could travel on to get across from the east side, which is huge contiguous concentration of poverty in the state of Minnesota, to get to the light rail. Well, there was some mitigation that happened after the outcry of the community, but we just can't, when we think of benefits, we can't just be thinking how it's benefiting the people that are going through a community. We also have to think about how we're impacting the mobility of people in a community who may not even have a car. So I needed to mention that so we think about those when we think about the wholeness of our transportation system and not just about moving cars fast.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have two questions. One is, when you view the advisory signs that are lit up that says lane open to all traffic, oftentimes those are positioned where there is a double white line. Are we able to ignore the white lines when it's open to all traffic, or do you have to still obey those? And then the second question is with regard to this questions about the discounted tolling and privilege. Does MnDOT have the authority in state statute to giving preference to any one group of people, or is this some type of rulemaking authority? Where do you derive that authority?
Mr. Carey?
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative, I'll take the first question here on the double white line issue. The double white lines are actually restricted 24/7. There's no time exclusion to that. So even if the lane is open to all traffic and the tolling no longer exists, that double white line would still be enforceable.
And Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative, there is language. I don't actually, I do have a copy of the statute in the legislative report, but don't have it open right now. But there is a provision in there that I believe gives sufficient authority to the department to test a pilot program such as this. it refers to being able to implement these lanes in accordance with the requirements of the Commissioner of Transportation. So I guess without, it's probably something that would probably need to be answered by legal counsel in a little more detail, but at least from our perspective and the research we've done on it, we do believe we have sufficient legal authority to do it.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you talk a little bit about the hours of operation of the HOV lanes and setting them? I know we've maybe had a little bit of discussion. Sometimes their rush hour has passed, yet you're still prohibiting. People could improve their commutes at 6 o'clock instead of waiting till 7 o'clock or something to get in those lanes on the ride home and this and that.
Mr. Carey.
Madam Chair and Representative, the reason why we have the hours the way they are is to really handle kind of all scenarios that might occur on that corridor, whether it's recurring congestion or even non-recurring congestion, non-recurring congestion being that might be caused due to weather or incidents on that corridor. And really a lot of it boils down to is maintaining that advantage for transit and carpool vehicles, as well as MinPass customers alike, that even if you might be in those later hours of the peak period, if there was an incident that was to occur, or maybe there was heavier congestion because of an event or weather, that we want to still maintain that advantage. Most hot lane systems throughout the country are actually 24/7, so ours are kind of unique in that aspect that we are just limited to those peak hours.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question and a comment. Back to the discounted lanes. During this tour this summer, we were actually told that one of the purposes of this pilot program was to encourage lane use. And so I would question then, how do you reconcile that with the stated purpose of the lane, which is to provide that reliable, congestion-free option? And just a comment, you know, I represent an area that is really a bedroom community. We have a significant number of commuters in my district who are very much affected by the 35 MinPass lane. We're also happen to be a very expensive county to live in, and I know my constituents have limited dollars, and they have to choose how those dollars are spent, and they may not qualify for these low-income programs, but that doesn't mean they have the expendable income to spend on sort of luxury items like using the MinPass lane. So I just want to put that out there as a comment, but also just the question about reconciling those two things.
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and Representative, certainly with these discount programs, we are trying to incent more people to use the lanes to take advantage of the benefits they provide. There is still some capacity in these lanes during peak periods, and so these programs are designed to try to improve that. They're also designed, the low-income discount program, there is a lot of concern out there among people that these lanes need to be more equitable and need to do more for people that cannot afford to drive on them. And so that's also part of the reason for low-income discount program. For the veterans program, it's to the purpose of it is primarily to thank veterans and active military for their service. So those are the primary reasons behind why we'd like to test both of these programs.
Okay, we're going to just take one more question and then be on to our next report. So, Representative Hertas.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to that statement, if the purpose of the MinPass lane is to incentivize free-flowing traffic and you raise the prices during the most congested times, why would you be offering discounts to increase the traffic in the lane? It seems to be counterproductive to what the goal is.
Representative, or Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and Representative, ideally we'd like to have these lanes as as full of vehicles and people as possible traveling at congestion-free speeds. So it's to try to get to the point where we have these lanes full but still moving at a congestion-free speed.
Well, I drive them.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you. I drive them every day, and it seems like if you want to incentivize people to get into the lane, you would want to not charge as much money during the peak time and encourage people to use it rather than charging more. Thank you.
Right. Well, we want to thank you, gentlemen, for your report, and learned a few things, and that's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next up is the highway construction cost and cost inflation study. And Mr. Gieske. Welcome, Mr. Gieske.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Gieske. I'm the director of the Office of Transportation System Management at MnDOT, which is our long-range planning and highway programming office at the department. So I'm going to be talking about the highway construction cost study. It's the part of the study that investigated the inflation question. And before I get into the results of the study, I just wanted to recall why you had asked for this report last year. Last year, about this time, it had become well known that the Federal Highway Administration had a construction cost index that was running at an inflation rate just a bit under 1%. It was actually 0.9%. And about that same time also, MnDOT had released its update of the Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan, and we were using a forecast inflation rate in more of the 4 to 5% kind of range. So the inflation rate is really important for long-range planning. It determines what kind of purchasing power you're going to have out in the future. And then when we were using a 5% inflation rate, and we looked out 20 years with the existing revenues, you had about half the purchasing power that you would have had in the current year based on that. So at 0.9%, that would look quite different. So this was really an excellent question to be looked at and investigated. And so with that, I will move ahead to the presentation. The study was asked for last year. The premise of the study was to identify and analyze the nature of the discrepancies in the highway construction costs and cost inflation estimates between Minnesota and the other federal and national measures. Some of the methods that we used to analyze this included an evaluation and survey of the practices currently being used at MnDOT, and a review of our construction cost index methodology and trends to evaluate if our construction cost index was overinflating the true cost of construction, and to determine by the marketplace, and a comparison of ours to the federal construction cost index. The law requested that we use an independent investigator, so we did hire the firm HDR to do the study for us. So also about the same time as this was all happening, shortly after the session ended in July 19th of 2017, the Federal Highway Administration coincidentally released an announcement that said that their National Highway Cost Construction Index 2.0 was now available. It was the first major revision since the FHWA had created this index in 2007. And they said that it reflects the steadily rising costs of highway construction and repair. So today, if you were to go to their website, you'll find this explanation that it gives. It says, as a part of its periodic review process, the FHWA conducted a diagnostic review of the index and the software program to identify and explore any potential issues with the calculation and results of the index. The effort addressed the stagnant or declining trend in the index values over the last several years, particularly since the second quarter of 2009, and noted that that trend in their index was not consistent with the price changes exhibited by other national-level price indicators, such as the Producer Price Index. So next slide here will give you a visual picture of what that looked like. On this chart, you'll see the top line is the new index, the 2.0 version, The bottom line is the old index. They both were started at 1 in 2003, and you can see that the old index went up and peaked in about 2006, kind of held steady, then dropped during the recession, and then just kind of stayed there at just above about a 1. So that was that low inflation rate, that 0.9% that that index was producing. With the new method, they went back and recalculated that, again, starting in 2003. And you see the similar trend of price index going up, hitting a peak in 2008 with the same drop at the time of the recession in 2009, and then going back up again a little more steeply than the old index did. So you're getting a different inflation rate demonstrated there. And I'll be saying a little bit more about that later when we compare this to the MnDOT numbers. So
Mr. Giese, could I just pause you a minute? And Representative Hertas, question?
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, in the private sector, and I'm part of that, I have built roads and dedicated roads and local streets to communities, and I'm about to embark on paying for a county improvement. And what's come to my attention of recent is that local units of government, and particularly the county, in the design and engineering of a project seem to budget about 25% of the total cost of the construction to design and engineering. Can you comment what MnDOT uses as a budget for the cost of constructing our roads and highways? Is your design and engineering costs as high as I'm experiencing it at other levels of local government?
Mr. Giese.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I don't know the exact number. We haven't done a study on that recently. Typically, when we use a rule of thumb, we talk about 17%, but it's 17% or possibly a bit more in general.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, please proceed, Mr. Giese.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll get back then to the questions that were being asked of us to be included in the study. The first request was to include an overview of the highway construction cost and cost estimation issues. The consultant identified five issues, or perhaps challenges, you might call them, that we face when estimating inflation and doing other kinds of cost estimates. So the five that he identified, the first one is bid prices. Bid prices tend to be kind of variable, sometimes for reasons not related to the inflation rate or other economic reasons. For example, one of the ways that we might get a different spin on the inflation rate that's not representative of national or other state trends. If you have a very large project and you attract an atypical contractor, someone who hasn't bid in your area before, might move into the area and try to submit a lower bid with the hopes of increasing their chances of being successful in this new market. That's just an example of one of the things that makes it difficult to predict based on bid prices. The second item that he identified was project scope changing from year 5 to year 1. Project scoping is the process of taking what's really just an idea for a project and developing it into a more of a concrete proposal where you can know more about what kinds of things are included in the project. That typically happens in about year 4 or 5 in advance of construction. Between year 4 and 5 and the time it gets constructed, you have all kinds of different activities going on in project development, including speaking with the local partners, doing the design work, the investigative work to come up with the design. And so more than likely the estimate changes some in that amount of time. So that's something that has to be anticipated at the time of scoping. Again, just another challenge that we face when trying to come up with cost estimates. The third one is cost estimating technique. There are different methods of calculating the cost. There are some simpler methods that we use well out in advance. We have one that we call the length-width-depth method, where if you're doing a pavement project, you'll just figure out how long it is, how wide it is, and how deep it is, multiply that out times the cost per cubic foot of material, concrete or bituminous or gravel, whatever it is, add 15%, and there you have a really preliminary cost estimate. When you get later on, after scoping and into design, you start to get very specific information, like how many yards of gravel, how many gallons of oil, and all of those, where you can apply specific bid prices to those. So that's another way that cost estimating is challenged. Risk and contingency. Contingency is a common element in different kinds of cost estimates, but a risk and contingency element is something that we're still working on. It's still a challenge for us at MnDOT, and we recognize that, and we are continuing to work with our project managers to get more skilled at looking at not just the contingency amount, but looking at the actual risks that project faces and applying an appropriate contingency amount with the risk to try and make sure that we come closer to the eventual cost of the project. And then the last one is the construction cost index, which is what we use to adjust the estimate for inflation out to whatever year that the project is going to be constructed. Second request was to establish benchmarks with other states. These questions then that came after that, the three bullets below, were written, I think, with the premise that there was going to be some differences between Minnesota and the other states. And so when the differences between us and the Federal Highway Administration didn't appear to be as great, they took a little broader look at it, trying to look at the data between us and the other states and identify any pattern of anything that looked different, not necessarily just an increase in price, but just looking for differences. And so some of the things that they found then would be on the next slide here. Some of their findings. One thing that they noted was that in May of last year, an agency called the Midwest Economic Policy Institute had issued this report, and the study that they printed showed that Minnesota ranked as the eighth lowest cost state in terms of average annual highway construction costs per lane mile, and their conclusion from that was that the tracking of maintenance and rehabilitation costs related to our existing road infrastructure were indicative of Minnesota having effective highway cost management policies. So suggesting then that there was not a cause for differences to be looked at there. Other findings that they found then, MnDOT's index, they noted, follows the same trends as peer states in the Federal Highway Administration, and that yearly changes in the index are proportional to the other indices. And I'll show you a picture of that on the next slide when you get there.
Mr. Gieske, could I ask, when the peer states kind of went through your report a bit, but the peer states, five of them, is there anything about them that makes them higher cost? I mean, why were those five selected? Utah, Washington, there were three others. And would that in any way, you know, would selecting five other random states have changed the outcomes?
Madam Chair, I guess I don't know what their relative position was on the costs or what they faced. They were chosen because they were all northern states, had similar kind of climates, would have similar kind of materials and construction requirements. Whether they see a difference in the bid price for some other reason, I don't know the answer to that, but I couldn't find out if there was something about that in their selection.
All right, thank you.
Okay, and then the third bullet, 5 out of 8 years since the 2004, MnDOT's index was within 1% of the peer states and FHWA's measure, which again I'll show you here in a moment. About cost estimating, they noted that MnDOT's engineers' estimates are within the range of the Federal Highway Administration's guidelines, and that the difference between our MnDOT's engineers' estimate, which is the last one that they do right before letting, and the contract award averaged only about 2% difference. So they felt like they had found good information there to support the process that we were using. So then this is the picture that kind of tells the story. So if you look at this chart, what you'll see is there's three lines, and The blue one, which is the MnDOT line on top, it's pointed out by the notation there if you have a black and white copy. The red line, which is right at the one that's the lowest one in that dip around 2009, that's the red line. That's the Federal Highway Administration's 2.0 index. And then the peer states average, which, again, the peer states were Utah, Iowa, Montana, Ohio, and Washington, is the dashed line. And so the things that you'll notice about this is that MnDOT's annual cost index trend follows closely with the peer states. So when one goes up, the other goes up. When one goes down, the others go down. So they're following that same up and down trend. They're also staying relatively close to each other. You will notice, though, there's not one is not consistently higher or lower than the other. They weave up and down from each other. Their conclusion is that MnDOT is staying close to the peer state's average. The fourth request was to evaluate the methodology that we used for highway construction cost. This and the next slide is not going to do justice to the work that the consultant did for us. There's a lot of material in the report comparing a lot of details between our process and the other states' process. So this is just a quick summary of what they found. They found that MnDOT uses a different price index formula method for computing its construction cost index than that of the Federal Highway Administration. The trend analysis shows that they are reflective of each other over a 15-year period, and where there are differences, they say that there are economic variances that provide some insight into those differences. And when we look at the picture here on the next slide, I'll try and point some of that out. There's dozens of these kind of graphs in the report, so I picked this one out because I think it not only illustrates the conclusion that they came to, but it also is probably the best answer to the question that you had about the inflation rates.
Okay, Representative Hertaus, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, there's oftentimes said that with shekels come shackles, and I'm presuming that most of what you do probably involves federal dollars, has some type of a copay or some type of a receipt of revenue to build roads, especially the U.S. highways and the interstate roads, perhaps not on our state highways. Maybe there are not federal dollars, but I'm presuming there might be. You would know better. But because of that, I'm curious with regard to our cost of construction, because of those dollars, because of the fact that it's coming from the federal government, are there certain bidding qualifications, standards, or rules that you have to use with regard to quotes you get from the private sector that makes a certain standard because of those dollars that bidders have to adhere to that might not otherwise be the case if it were a more local road?
Mr. Dieske?
Madam Chair, Representative, there are some requirements for projects that have federal funds that are different than what we would use if we had state funds only.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hertaus.
And would you characterize those requirements as increasing the cost of building the roads?
Mr. Dieske?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would say that probably that's true. I don't know how much that is, but there are additional requirements.
Thank you.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back a couple of slides to page 9 in the presentation, I've got a methodology question, really. When comparing Minnesota to the peer states, why was Minnesota included in the peer state review? I mean, it seems that would skew those numbers at least somewhat towards Minnesota.
Mr. Gieske?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would be pretty sure that there is another figure that has it separated and shown in different ways. I merely chose this one because it was the simplest with only three lines on it. So I'm sure that's represented elsewhere with Minnesota in and out of that.
Representative New.
Madam Chair, I would be very interested in seeing sure. that additional slide. I assume that that would shift those numbers at least slightly. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to go one slide earlier than that and just go to the middle bullet point where it says 5 out of 8 years since 2004, which would take it to 2012, which is leaving quite a few years since then. And then it's 30% of the years aren't covered by that 1% of peer states. Do you know what variation it was for those 3 years as well? And do you know why it wasn't brought a little bit closer to 2015 rather than 2012 as final ending?
Mr. Gieske.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. Yeah, I'm not sure why they chose that, if that's when data was available. I do know that they did look at from March 2003 to June of 2014, we were at that 1% difference, but they also apparently had information out to July of 2017 when they said when you include the later years, it was 0.8% difference, so it became closer in the more recent years.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But here it says 5 out of 8 years since 2004, it was within 1%, meaning that 3 of those years, it was outside of that range. And so I was just curious as to how far outside, if it was just a few percentage points or what.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Gieske?
Yeah, I don't know that answer off the top of my head, but we can provide the year-by-year on that.
All right, great. Thank you. Is that the conclusion of the report?
Let's see. I think I have one more slide after. I'll finish up on this one just because it illustrates a couple of points. This is the comparison of the Federal Highway Administration's 2.0 version construction cost index compared to MnDOT's. And they both start in 2003 for this calculation and were made to start at 150. So this is the index value, not the inflation value that's showing on here. And some things that you can see about this is, again, it illustrates that when the federal index goes up, ours goes up, they both have peaks and valleys. A couple of things that they have noted about this is that the two indexes follow a similar trend. They both start with acceleration and growth in 2004 until 2008. They both decline during the recession and with a slower, more sluggish increase afterwards. One thing that they did note in particular, which you can see from this chart, is that in the first half of the chart, the Federal Highway Administration Index was higher, and in the course of the recession, they switched. They attributed they didn't have time to study the cause in particular, but they did speculate that our state economy and the construction sector in particular was not affected by the downturn as much as the national economy. So they're speculating our economy stayed stronger. One thing that we know about 2008 was that was when the Chapter 152 bridge program was funded, which may or may not be the factor, but it is a coincidence as to why that may have occurred at that particular time. And now, the last slide, provide recommendations for any changes to be made. So the report found no recommendations for changes in the law, although they did recommend that MnDOT monitor the new Federal Highway Administration and the peer states' construction cost indices on a regular basis so that we can compare ourselves and benchmark and be alert to any possibility that our method might be deviating from what others are using. And they also recommended that we pilot test some other inflation estimating methods. They did note that our method was different than several of the others that they looked at, and that there might be some things that that we could investigate and possibly include into our method if we found value in them. So that is our intention, to at least take a look at those and see if some of those can be added. And that's the conclusion.
Representative Newman.